Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for tuning in. Good to have you with us. We are coming to you from the west coast of Sweden, up in Scandinavia. You can find us 24/7 from around the world, where internet is accessible through our website, redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. Glad to have you here today. We have Marcus Allen with us on the line. He is the UK publisher of Nexus magazine. Marcus is also one of the speakers that will be on the Beyond Knowledge conference that we have mentioned during our two previous programs with Ralph Ellis and Jerry E. Smith. I know that Marcus will be talking about the moon landings on the conference, the alleged moon landings, and we might touch upon that a little bit later here today as well. And Marcus is into a lot of different subjects, like the technology of ancient Egypt, Emmanuel Velikovsky, to crop circles, 9/11, and the crystal skulls. Fascinating topics, all of them, and these are some of the areas that we'll be going into here today with Marcus. The website that you can check out in regards to Nexus Magazine is simply www.nexusmagazine.com. That, by the way, got a very nice facelift a while back, so the website looks new and fresh. Very, very good to see that. So again, the website is nexusmagazine.com. So with that, let's say welcome to our guest here. Thank you for coming on the program, Marcus. Nice to have you with us.
It's a pleasure, Henrik, and thank you very much for inviting me. I look forward to our discussion.
Definitely, me too. It's great to have you here, as I said, and what I like to do is to start off and talk a little bit about yourself and maybe the background that you have in regards to the Nexus magazine. This, of course, is an Australian publication, I guess, from the beginning. Duncan Rhodes down in Australia started this up. But how did you get involved in this project or in this magazine, Marcus?
Well, my involvement actually dates back to 1994. I was shown a copy of Nexus magazine by some friends down in Glastonbury, and I thought, oh, this looks an interesting magazine. I think I'll get hold of a copy, and I found that they weren't available in England. If I wanted to have a copy of Nexus at that time, I had to subscribe to the Australian office, and I thought, no, if I'm interested in Nexus, there must be other people in Britain who are interested in Nexus. So I got in touch with the editor, with Duncan Rhodes, out in Australia, and said, look, I'd like to distribute Nexus in the UK. So he said, well, that sounds good. I'm interested in doing that as well. Come out and we'll have a chat. So as you do, I went out to Australia. Actually, it was my 25th wedding anniversary as well, so it was a double trip.
Right.
And we were able to get out there, and I met up with Duncan, and we got on very well. And he said, well, give it a go. See how you get on. We do have subscribers in Britain, but not very many. I think there were about 30 subscribers at that time. And so I came back to England with some copies of Nexus and a promise that I would have the distribution rights to Nexus for the UK and for Europe. And I set about trying to interest people in Nexus, in reading it, and to do that, I decided that the best way was to attend various conferences and conventions that would attract people who might well have an interest in the subject matter of Nexus. So the first conference I attended was the Fortean Times Unconvention in 1994, and a lot of people expressed considerable interest in the magazine. They said, oh, this is really interesting. I'd like to subscribe. So I found that there were people interested. And so I continued that way, and I thought, well, I need to get some shops to sell Nexus now. So I put some copies in the back of the car, and I drove around as many shops as I thought would be interested and said, well, would you like to sell the magazine? They said, we'll give it a go. And that's how it started. This was, 14 years ago.
Right.
And it gradually built up, and I thought, well, I don't know how it's going to work, so let's just give it 6 months and see what happens. And 6 months went by, and the subscriptions increased significantly. There were now about 200 or 300 subscribers. So I thought, oh, there's a demand for this information. There's a demand for Nexus in the UK. the next step is obviously to get distribution through newsstands and through general bookstores at airports and railway stations and high streets, and hopefully some distribution in Europe as well. So I made contact with one of the main magazine distributors in Britain, which is the Seymour Magazine Distribution, and they took us on, and their method of doing it is much as you would expect. They contact all the major distributors like W.H. Smith and Martins and Gibbs. These are the main news agents in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And they took samples and put them on sale, and people bought them, which is what we wanted.
Now, were there any kind of, you know, questions, you know, no, this is very fringe material, we have nothing to do with this, or did I just, you know, okay, sounds good, we'll take it? What happened?
Yep. People like W.H. Smith, who are the main news agents in Britain, they are business people. If they have a product that will sell on their shelves, they will take it.
Right.
Now, obviously, one has to be a little bit careful. You can't publish libelous or slanderous material. You can't say things which are incorrect just for the sake of saying them, and we are particularly careful that we don't cause offense in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But if we criticize companies or organizations, then we'll do that, but we can always back it up with the evidence required.
Right.
And we've been distributed by W.H. Smith and major news agents like Borders, who have got a major presence in Britain at the moment, for about 12 years, and we've had no problems at all. In fact, from our initial 30 subscribers who were subscribing to Nexus before I was involved, we now sell around 12,000 copies per issue.
There we go. That's very good.
So it's a successful magazine. There is a demand for the information in Nexus.
Mm.
And if anybody is unfamiliar with Nexus, as Henrik said, please try our website. You'll find some sample articles available for you to read on it. Not all of them. And then your next step will be to contact the UK office and get a subscription.
Right, right. So, I mean, how the when the web became very popular, so to speak, what happened then? Did the subscriptions go down because many people could find the same type of information on the web, or did it increase? What happened when that came about?
Well, we find that with the information available on the web, this has actually increased our sales, because not everybody is online. Not everybody likes to use computers in that sort of detailed way to search out information.
Right.
To have it available, or to have the sort of information that they are interested in reading about contained in one magazine, is quite often the way a lot of people like to receive their information. I mean, it's as simple as saying that you can always take a magazine into the bath and read it in the bath.
Right, right.
You can't take a computer into your bath. It's not quite so, you know, you drop the computer in the bath, you've got a wrecked computer. You've got the magazine in your bath, you've got a wet magazine.
Right, right,
that's
right.
It. So
that's
many
great.
People we find are much more willing to acquire their information in this way. They use Nexus as a starting point for research into a subject which may have a particular interest for them.
Right, right.
Now, I should say that Nexus has no political, religious, or philosophical connections at all. It's a totally independent magazine.
Mm.
In fact, we have carried articles in the past which have been critical of certain areas of religion.
Right.
Not least of which is Christianity. We've researched that in considerable detail, or published the research of other people in considerable detail.
Right.
We've looked into Buddhism, specifically Tibetan Buddhism, and published a fairly critical article on that. And if one knows the history of Buddhism, specifically in Tibet, which of course is rather in the news these days, it is surprising what information can be obtained. And now these are done by specialist researchers, and that is the purpose of Nexus, is really to publish the work of specialist researchers in subjects which wouldn't normally get as broad an airing as their work appears to imply. Nexus has a very broad circulation. We publish in Nexus really six major subjects. We look behind the news in what goes on. We published a lot of articles about the Bilderberg organization, for instance.
Right.
We publish articles on health, alternative health, looking at possible treatments for certain major diseases such as cancer, AIDS. The current article in the present issue of Nexus is tooth decay, how to deal with that. We look into future science. Now, that would be, I suppose one could describe it clearly as saying, well, cars that run on water.
Right.
Now, those exist. The way in which energy can be generated in a way that is described as over-unity, or to give it its more colloquial term, free energy. There are many people researching these areas, and this is something that Nexus readers like to keep up to date with. What is going on? And that is the great strength of the editor, that he can acquire the information from right around the world, whether it's from Russia or from America, from Sweden. We published articles from Sweden, from Europe, right across Australia, obviously, China, we published articles from. So it's a worldwide magazine with information from right around the world.
Right.
We also obviously publish articles on UFOs when it's appropriate to do so. The paranormal, the unexplained. We also look at what we describe generally as hidden history. The sort of history which not everybody is familiar with, but a lot of research has been carried out saying that the history we believe or we are told happened isn't necessarily the only story that should be told about it.
Right.
Because as we know, history is written by the winners.
That's right.
And sometimes there are other stories which one can talk about. For instance, the British version of what happened during World War II is not the same as the Russian version of what happened in World War II.
That's right.
Or the German version of what happened in World War II. And so to get the complete picture enables people to make far more informed and important choices and decisions about how their life should be led and how their politicians should behave.
Now, the magazine that comes out in Australia, is that the same one that comes out up here or in Europe or England, or is there any kind of editorial difference between the magazines?
No, the magazine that is published in Australia is the same as the English language versions which are published in both Europe and in America in New Zealand.
Right.
There are also foreign language editions which are published in France, in Italy, in Greece, in Croatia, in Russia, in Poland, in Romania, in Japan. So these ones are all published in those languages.
Right.
But what they do is to take the original articles from Nexus and translate them.
Right, right.
And then publish them in those languages. Now, those offices are run quite independently, as all Nexus offices are all independent. We just distribute the magazine.
I see.
So what you get in Australia is what you get in Britain. The only difference, obviously, will be in the advertisements.
Yeah, okay.
More local, the advertisements, because they're more appropriate, say, to Britain and Europe than they would be to Australia.
Right, right. Okay, very interesting. So that's a very good overview, I guess, of what Nexus magazine is, and it's been around for a long time, and it's still there. Is it growing all the time? Do you feel that it's an increase of interest in these kinds of subjects that you mentioned?
There there is a continual increase. In fact, Nexus magazine was originally published in the autumn of 1987. So it's been going just over 20 years. Duncan Rhodes took over as editor in 1990, and he's been the editor ever since. He changed the magazine, the format of the magazine. It was much more of a, I suppose one should say, a new age type of magazine originally. But he did a survey of the readers that existed, this is in 1990, saying, what do you want more of? What do you want less of? What do you want to know about? And he adapted the magazine to that format, which is to include hard-edged science-based articles. Articles on, basically articles on subjects that can be researched and can be followed up.
I see,
And that was the main change that Duncan took place when he took over.
Very good. So, I mean, that sounds like very much in the areas of what you yourself are interested in. So I guess that this fit perfectly together, so to speak, with what you are interested in and so forth. Do you write anything for Nexus right now, or do any research for Nexus?
I don't write very much. I have written one article for Nexus, and that was to do with crop circles, but that was about 10 years ago. My strength, if it's anything, is in being able to sell and distribute the magazine. And that's what I like to do, because the subject matter of Nexus is an area that I've had a personal interest in for over 40 years. So it is, I'm very fortunate to be able to say that my hobby is my job.
Well, that's
and I've combined, I've been able to combine an interest in unexplained phenomena, unexplained mysteries, hidden history, many things into what I do. So I respect Duncan's decisions in the editorial side. In fact, I don't know of anybody who has a broader understanding of all these subjects than Duncan Rhodes. I wouldn't consider myself in a position to be able to challenge that or even to write better than many of the contributors that we have in Nexus.
Sounds very good. And, I mean, you've been interesting, and I guess you're also doing research, so to speak, on the side. You mentioned crop circles, for instance, that's one. But there's many other subjects that, that you're interested in and have been looking at. One of those is... of course, Egypt, as we mentioned, the technology of Egypt and so forth, and how this, I guess, connects with some of Velikovsky's theories, isn't that right?
Very much so. Yes. I mean, one of the things I do is to give presentations. I do talks at conferences, and I find that quite an interesting way of getting across information. And one of the areas that I have a particular interest in was Egypt. The technology of Egypt. Now, when I say technology, I'm talking about the granite of Egypt. If anybody has been to Egypt, they will be obviously familiar with the Great Pyramid, and the Temple of Karnak, Temple of Luxor, Aswan, and the unfinished obelisk. And I went there a few years ago. I visited Egypt, very fortunately, with a group of people who were of like mind. We're all Nexus readers, and the tour guide was John Anthony West, who's obviously familiar with the challenge he has issued years ago to the dating of the Sphinx. And I was very interested to go with him on the tour, where he was able to point out many of the anomalies to do with the Sphinx and the anomalies to do with the Great Pyramid. And I followed that up by giving talks on the subject, and specifically looking at the granite that is used in Egypt. Now, most of the pyramid that you look at is made of limestone, which is has been quarried quite close to the pyramid site at Giza. But inside the Great Pyramid, you'll be familiar with the King's Chamber, and which is a granite-lined room. Quite big, and inside this granite-lined room is what's called the sarcophagus,
right,
which in turn is made of granite. A point that not many people are actually aware of is that this granite sarcophagus, which is still inside the King's Chamber, and you can go and lie in it if you want to, it's not very comfortable, but you can get inside it,
right,
is that this sarcophagus is too big to go through the only entrance into the King's Chamber, which is a relatively small doorway, about 3 foot square.
Mm-hmm.
The sarcophagus is at least 1 inch too wide and 1 inch too high to enter this doorway.
Mm.
So the question immediately arises is, how did they get it in?
Right, right, of course.
And it couldn't have been, as the Egyptologists continually insist, that it's a tomb. The Great Pyramid is a tomb.
Right.
And the sarcophagus was the coffin of the Pharaoh Khafre. No, it's not. They couldn't get it in. So the only logical explanation is that the sarcophagus was placed in the Great Pyramid, in the King's Chamber, while it was being built.
Yeah.
Because they had to then put the roof on, and there are five layers of granite blocks. Each of block weighs 50 tons on top of it.
Mm. And
so
how
the
question,
heck... Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and how the heck did they do that, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
How on earth do you raise a 50-ton block of granite 200 foot into the air, which is the height of the King's Chamber above ground level? How do you raise it 50 foot into the air?
Right.
And even more questionable is, how do you get a 50-ton block of granite from Aswan, which is 600 kilometers south of the pyramid, in the first place?
Mm.
And you don't just get one block, you get 70 of them. And you think, hang on a minute, is this really the easiest way to build a pyramid inside of which is a granite-lined room? What are they doing?
Mm.
And how do you cut the granite? Now, an interesting follow-up to that is, if you go to Aswan, which is where all the granite in Egypt actually comes from,
mm-hmm,
it's the only site in Egypt from which the granite that is in the Great Pyramid, the granite that is in the Assyrian at Abydos, which is north of Luxor, and in the quarries at Aswan, you can see what is called the unfinished obelisk. Unfinished because it's still attached to the bedrock.
Right, right.
Because it when it was cut, it was a big trench has been cut around it. The trench is about 3 kilometers deep. Sorry, not 3 kilometers, 3 meters deep.
Right.
All around this obelisk. It's an obelisk shape. And the reason it was unfinished is because it cracked, or there was a big crack in it, and they couldn't then finish it and take it out in one piece. It would have broken.
Mm.
So the question I asked was, how did they cut this trench, which is 3 meters deep, about 1 meter across, and in terms of length, all around this obelisk, which is 42 meters long, we're talking a trench approaching 100 meters. Now, if you ask the question, how did they cut this trench, you will be told they used diorite balls to pound the granite to dust.
Hmm.
That is the only explanation that is offered.
Hmm.
And I said, I don't believe it.
Right.
Because you can do the calculation quite simply. If you take these diorite balls, of which there are several lying around even now, they look like a big bowling ball. They're about 30 centimeter in diameter. They're quite heavy because they're made of an even harder granite, an even harder material than granite. And you can use one of these to pound the granite surface. Now, if you do the calculations again, how many cubic centimeters of granite can you pound per hour with these diorite balls?
No idea.
But not many.
Not many, exactly.
Not
yeah.
many.
Yeah.
Now, if you do the full calculation, if you had people squatting, which is presumably what they were doing with their pounding diorite balls, squatting side by side around this 100-meter-long trench, how long would it take them to get down 3 meters? And the answer is 17 years.
There we go. Very good.
Now, that's not half of it, because you've now got to pound underneath
obelisk, that...
remove it from the bedrock.
Sheesh, my God. Where do you begin? You know, how the heck do you do that?
Exactly.
Well, it's not doable. I mean, it's ridiculous.
So that explanation, which is the only explanation you will be offered by an Egyptologist when you ask that question.
Huh.
And if you then laugh at him and say, no, it doesn't make sense, because the hieroglyphic descriptions indicate that it took a few weeks
right.
to remove the obelisks. You have to come up with another solution. Now, the only other solution I have come up with is something which occurred or was reported originally in a book written by David Hatcher Childress, who incidentally will be one of the speakers at the Beyond Knowledge conference in
right.
May.
Yeah.
He reported a description given to Colonel Fawcett. Now, people may not be familiar with that name, but Colonel Fawcett was an explorer in the 1920s. He was a British Army officer, and he disappeared in the Amazonian jungle. But he wrote up a lot of the explorations he did before his disappearance. And one of these descriptions was of what was referred to as rock softening liquid.
Okay.
Produced from plants from the Amazonian rainforest. Now, we know that there are plants in the Amazonian rainforest which can produce some remarkable properties.
Indeed.
Such as the liquid put on a poison tip arrow.
Right.
Made from plants and vines and leaves from the Amazonian rainforest. The rock softening liquid was similarly derived from plants. Now, I don't know which plants. I've been trying to find out. And interestingly, as a friend of mine was in Machu Picchu at Christmas, his daughter was being married and to a Peruvian. He went to Machu Picchu, and I asked him to try to get an answer to this question. Is anybody aware of the rock softening liquid?
Mm.
And he came back and he said, yes, they know about it. It is something which is known. My son-in-law's grandmother knew about it.
Okay.
But she hadn't seen it for many years, but she was familiar with the concept of a rock-softening liquid. Now, if you're familiar with some of the megalithic structures in South America, specifically around Machu Picchu,
yeah,
and what is known in English as Sexy Woman, which is the colloquial pronunciation for the enormous walls of megalithic rocks placed in position so closely to each other that you cannot get a piece of paper between them.
Yeah.
It appears that it was a well-known technique in South America at the time of the construction of Machu Picchu, which nobody actually knows what the dates are, and that was exported to Egypt. Now, it could have been the other way around. It could have been from Egypt to South America, but it's unlikely because the plants are not available in Egypt as they are in South America.
And again, that opens up a whole another can of worms, meaning that, oh, okay, but we're told that, you know, sea travels didn't occur on that level and a communication between those. But again, there's much evidence suggesting that it actually did, right?
Absolutely. I think what Thor Heyerdahl did was extremely important, that he was able to demonstrate with Kon-Tiki and then subsequently with Ra, with the two boats that he built, that it was quite possible to travel between Africa and South America, as the Chinese did in 1421, when they circumnavigated the world.
Right, right.
And mapped the world And the maps that the Chinese produced in 1421 are the maps that we, or Columbus, was familiar with when he went to America. He didn't go without a map. He knew exactly where he was going.
Of course, of course.
But of course, that's gone a long way from Egypt. But
yeah, I see.
All these things lead together. And of course, this is the fascination of the subject.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You get into one subject and it leads on to another subject and it leads into another area.
Right, right.
But to come back to the rock softening liquid and the possible use in Egypt of the same material to remove granite. As I did when I visited Aswan, I was familiar with the concept of the rock softening liquid, so I looked for evidence that it might have been used, and I found it.
Hmm.
In this trench around the unfinished obelisk are what look like scoop marks. The same marks you would get if you take a block of ice cream and pull a spoon across the top of it.
Right.
You will get a shallow trench with a circular base. And those are the exact same marks you will get around the unfinished obelisk, these scoop marks.
Right, right.
As if somebody has used a rock softening liquid and then scooped out the soft rock.
I'm looking at a picture of this unfinished obelisk in Aswan right now as we speak, and I totally agree with what you're saying. This is absolutely what it looks like. I'm going to have a picture of this, by the way, also up on the website so people can see this for themselves, and you're absolutely right. Fascinating.
That would be a very interesting point to make, and thank you for that. That's very helpful because it illustrates this point, because it appears so improbable that you can get a liquid that softens granite. But with the evidences presented in front of you that it not been pounded with diorite balls, I would contend that the rock was softened. It didn't take very long to do it. All you needed was sufficient liquid to soften the rock. You would scoop it out. It would then become... It would be rather like concrete today, where you mix up concrete and you can smooth it and form it into particular areas, and then it goes hard.
Mm.
The original concrete used was lime-based rather than Portland cement-based.
Right.
And lime-based cement will crumble to dust quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
But it is strong enough to hold whole houses and buildings together.
Hmm.
So the idea is there. It's just that nobody has considered that this sort of research should be carried out. And if we go on burning the rainforest down at the speed we're doing it, we may not even find the plants that we used, and we'll never know the answer.
Mm, well, exactly, yeah. It's incredible. Yeah. I mean, and one question that arises, the idea that, you know, if they manage to do this or to pull this off, first of all, okay, how do they get the knowledge? That's interesting in itself, but... Do you know if there's any kind of correlation to that today, meaning that have we developed any kind of acid that can, you know, burn through rock like this? Similar, do you know?
Well, it's interesting you say that. Now, one thing that I wanted to test out was whether it was possible, given the technology that we knew existed in Egypt, they were obviously familiar with electricity. In various forms. The Baghdad battery, I think, is possibly an indicator that the generation of electricity was possible or was understood. That could then be used to electroplate material. If the Egyptians had a concept of electricity, they might... Now, I have no evidence to say this, but it is a logical progression. They might have been able to electrolyze water.
Uh-huh.
You pass an electric current through water.
Right.
And you get the two constituent parts of water, hydrogen and oxygen, given off as a gas.
Right.
Gas of hydrogen, gas of oxygen. If those two gases are combined in the same proportion as they exist in water, i.e., two of oxygen to one of hydrogen. Sorry, I've got that wrong way around. H2O, two of hydrogen, one of oxygen.
Right.
You will get what is referred to today as Brown's gas.
Okay. How do you spell that? Brown's?
Brown.
Brown's gas. Okay, I see.
Brown's gas.
Yeah, all right.
Like brown as in the color brown.
Gotcha.
It is named after the developer of this.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the inventor. His name was Yule Brown. That's Y-U-L-L.
Mm-hmm.
He was Hungarian, but lived in Australia for many years, and that's where he developed it. By combining these two gases and using it in the way that you would use oxyacetylene today for welding. Now, I have seen this being done. If you get a Brown's gas generator, it is a little thing that's the size of a small table, and it generates Brown's gas by electrolyzing water.
Hmm.
I wanted to experiment and see if it was possible to melt granite.
Right.
Now, if you put an oxyacetylene torch onto granite, what happens is that the granite explodes.
Okay.
It's very dangerous.
Hmm.
What is happening is that all the various constituent parts of the granite heat up at the same temperature, and some of them will heat faster than others.
Okay.
If part of the, say, the feldspar heats up faster than the mica, two constituent parts of granite, quartz would be another. If they heat at the same speed, some heat faster than others, and they will expand faster and explode, and that's what's dangerous. When I put the Brown's gas flame onto granite, it melted and became like a liquid that flowed quite easily.
Right.
Then, obviously, once it cooled down, it hardened.
Uh-huh.
The remarkable thing about Brown's gas, for any engineer who is used to working with oxyacetylene to do welding, is that using Brown's gas, you can weld aluminium to tungsten. Now, that would be impossible normally, because they have completely different melting points,
okay,
those two metals.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen it done. I have seen tungsten, a piece of tungsten, welded to a piece of aluminium. It is quite remarkable, the properties of Brown's gas.
Hmm.
And there is a website, which if you want to follow up any more anything to do with Brown's gas, eagleresearch.com.
EagleResearch.com.
It's an American-based company, and they sell equipment to generate Brown's gas. Ironically, the Chinese are the major producers of Brown's gas generators today.
Hmm. With this, you can also melt certain metals and things like this also.
Yep. You can melt metals. You can weld metals, and all it costs is the electricity to electrolyze the water. It's portable. Brown's gas has remarkable properties. You can pass the flame over your hand, and it will not burn you. You can then transfer that same flame to a piece of granite, and it will melt it.
And
what appears to happen is that the flame adapts to the material it's in contact with.
Okay, I see what you mean. So it only applies to different, you know, properties of the material, meaning that, as you say, it only reacts to a certain kind of what, molecular structure or?
That's right. It's the molecular structure that's important.
Hmm.
It's not been researched in any great degree. There are people working on it in many parts of the world.
Uh-huh.
There are many companies that claim to have the rights to produce it. In fact, it's free to anybody who wants to do the research. But one of the most interesting areas which is being developed is in fuel economy, petrol economy.
Okay.
By introducing Brown's gas into an internal combustion engine, you can reduce petrol consumption by major amounts. That is a particularly interesting area of research. Another is health, where the use of Brown's gas can be very beneficial in the treatment of certain illnesses and diseases.
Okay.
But again, this is very early research. But again, Nexus magazine is where you get this information originally. We were the first to publish on it.
Very interesting indeed. Yeah, so this is pioneering research that is being done. And I mean, if we tie this back again then to the technology, as it were, of the Egyptians, are you suggesting also that it's possible that they could have used something similar, that they had similar knowledge about water and how to apply this or mix this, I guess we can say, with the electricity then?
Definitely, yeah. This is the point, that we're only beginning to understand how advanced the Egyptian technology was. It's almost more advanced than we can understand today. Now, one of the people who's done a lot of fascinating research into this whole area of Egyptian technology is an author by the name of Christopher Dunn.
Right.
And he wrote, a few years ago, he wrote a book called The Giza Power Plant.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're familiar with that, you'll know that Christopher Dunn is, still is, an engineer by profession. He's a high technology engineer. He works on jet engines and similarly high tech equipment, building them, testing them, and ensuring their long life.
Mm.
So he understands technology. What he wanted to do was to back engineer the Great Pyramid. It's obviously not a tomb. He said, well, if it's not, what is it?
Right.
And his book, The Giza Power Plant, is the story of what he did in terms of engineering. And it is from that many of the starting points that I had for looking at the technology of Egypt derived. Because as an engineer, he examined many of the granite pieces in Egypt, pieces just lying around on the Giza Plateau.
Mm.
And said, these are pieces, we couldn't make these today. We don't have the technology to do what they did. Compound curves on decorative items.
Right, right.
Multi-sided blocks of granite together. We don't have that technology. What were they using?
Sorry to interrupt there, but one question that arises, and I wanted to ask about your theory or idea about that, in if you're familiar with it, and that's one theory that the entire pyramid, or many of the pyramids in Giza and other places, of course, were actually put together. Some say through actually resonance and things like this, so that the blocks were much in the similar way that we pour in concrete and it hardens. You know what I mean? Do you think that is a possibility here? Then, take in what you've been referring to here?
It's a possibility. I'm familiar with that idea that the Great Pyramid was built with blocks that were not quarried out of the ground, but were cast, rather
right.
Like we would cast concrete blocks today.
Right, right.
But it still leaves open the question of how you get the granite there, because that wasn't cast.
Right.
It is quite possible that some of it was. Again, this is now referring to a technology which we're not familiar with.
Of course.
In terms of Egypt's construction.
Hmm.
One of the problems that many people have with Egypt is that they are familiar with many of the great buildings and the ruins, like the Great Pyramid. Many people are familiar with that. It's one of possibly the most famous single structure on the planet.
Right.
But there are many other buildings, specifically around Luxor, like the Luxor Temple and the Karnak Temple.
Yeah.
The Valley of the Kings, Abu Simbel Temple that was moved in 1968, stop it being drowned. But most of these were built by later pharaohs. They were built by Ramesses II. The Abu Simbel Temple was built by Ramesses II.
Mm.
Now, he was a pharaoh for about 60 years, so he had a lot of time to do these things.
Mm.
But he was living around 1200 BC, quite recent in terms of what we perceive as being the more ancient Egypt.
Right.
The Egypt of the Great Pyramid, the Egypt of the Osirian at Abydos. Not the more modern temples, it's the older ones that I have the fascination with. Most of the more recent ones are very well documented. They're all made of limestone. It's very easy to carve limestone and sandstone. You can even use copper chisels on them, which is apparently all the Egyptians had to build these things with.
Right.
But you can't use copper chisels on granite.
No, no.
It doesn't work. So we've got a problem.
I see what you mean, and exactly that's important to point out that, because again, all I mean, it's, we're not just talking about, you know, no, they build it in stone. This it's different properties to this, the character of the stone, what, you know, tools and metals you actually can use to you know, build things with and so forth. So very important point to make again, and that image, it's fascinating, that one with the unfinished the obelisk at Abydos, right?
Yeah. You'll see that there are scoop marks on top of the obelisk as well.
Right, right.
As in the trench around the surrounding it.
Now, one more question before we actually need to pretty soon here talk a little bit about your appearance on the conference and so forth, because we are actually running out of time in our first hour. But before we do that, I just want to pop one more question about this bayou, and that is, if this was you know, melted or whatever words you want to use there, the granite. Then, when this was made, do you think that, I mean, does this only the liquid that's this or bronze gas, does this only penetrate down to a certain level of the rock? What I'm getting at is that if this was true, wouldn't the entire, you know, piece of granite there melt, or can it be applied in such a way that only, you know, a few centimeters of this can be scooped out? Do you know?
I would say that is more likely to be the case, that it would be... let's assume that this liquid existed, or exists. What you would do is use it rather like... you would use paint stripper. You would paint it on the surface of the rock, and it would soften it down to, let's say, a depth of about 2 to 3 centimeters. Which you could then scrape off or shape.
Right.
In the way that if you take, say, putty or plasticine, you can shape that quite easily. Or like clay, if you're making pottery, you can use the clay quite easily to shape any type of utensil.
Right.
With clay, obviously, you then have to bake it to harden it, and it becomes solid in a way that it cannot be then worked or shaped. In the same way, the granite could be softened once the material, the surplus material, is removed. There may be an application of another material to harden it, to stop the process of softening, that would then immediately cause the granite, which of course was originally in molten form when it came out of the earth, because all granite is volcanic material.
Of course, yeah.
As opposed to sandstone, which is compressed sand, and limestone, which is compressed sand again. Those are quite different materials.
Right.
And shouldn't be confused in any way. Granite is a very hard material. If it is possible to soften it, you could then treat it almost like clay and shape it into whatever shape you wanted. It wouldn't necessarily soften the whole thing, and I'm sure that the process could subsequently be reversed, either by a passing of a period of time where the softening process ceased and it obtained whatever shape was subsequently molded into it, or another liquid was applied which would stop the process
right
when the desired shape had been achieved. Because nobody knows what the answer is, I don't know what the answer is. All I can say is that this is a more likely explanation, given the evidence which actually does exist,
right,
than anything else. Now, one of the points that Christopher Dunn made very strongly, specifically about the granite sarcophagus in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, he took an engineering level metal that is absolutely flat, and it's used in engineering to ensure that surfaces are flat. And he applied this, it basically looks like a short ruler, short piece of metal. And he discovered that the sides, the internal dimensions of the sarcophagus are mirror flat. They are so flat, it exceeds the requirement for opticians. Now, this is quite unnecessary if it's a sarcophagus,
right,
which is something that people get buried in.
Right.
You don't need optical quality sides. He also discovered, and this is quite a well-known fact, that the sarcophagus inside the King's Chamber is one piece of granite. It is not five sides put together like a box.
Right, right.
It is one piece of granite hollowed out. And the hollowing out was done with drills because the marks are still visible. In the Cairo Museum, there are similar pieces where you can see drill marks. Now, to drill granite, you need diamonds, the only material that will cut granite.
Right.
But we know the Egyptians did not have access to diamonds. The nearest diamonds to Egypt are actually the other side of Africa, 1,000 miles away, on the west coast, in Sierra Leone.
Right.
So how did they cut it? Unless they had a technology that we're only beginning to discover today, which is ultrasonic drilling, where the material is actually vibrated at an extremely high speed and actually disintegrates. It is possible to do ultrasonic drilling on granite.
Right.
So the evidence would appear to indicate that that was the technology they used in order to hollow out this remarkable box inside the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. They used ultrasonic drilling.
Fascinating.
Sort of drilling that you have on, when you visit your dentist today.
Fascinating. And again, this is just some of the inconsistencies, as it were, to what the official storyline gives and what kind of, at least as you said, these are possibilities that need to be considered if we are to get the full picture of what has been going on, you know?
Indeed.
Yeah.
I do have a lot of sympathy for Egyptologists because they may have spent a lifetime studying the subject, but they're beginning to discover, as a result of the work of many, shall we say, alternative historians and people looking for more logical explanations, that much of their work has still to be done.
Right, right.
They may know the pharaohs, but they got the dates of those wrong as well. Let's leave that, shall we?
You know what? What we need to do like this, that we're approaching the end of our time together, so what I want to do is just talk a little bit about the upcoming conference, Beyond Knowledge, mentioned that, and also just we could do a brief overview, because we don't have time in this segment at least to go into all the subjects of what you will be discussing, but again, you will be talking about the moon landings there, and I want to mention here then that the Beyond Knowledge conference is taking place between the 3rd and 4th of May in Liverpool, England. So if you're interested in hearing either Marcus Allen here, that we've been talking to here in this program today, or some other guys that will be attending, like David Hatcher Childress, Jerry Smith, Michael Tessarion, Ken Thomas, Ralph Ellis, Ian Crane, and David Griffin. Those are the speakers that will be on this conference. I suggest that you pop over to their website for more information about tickets, times, and how to get there and so forth. The website is beyond-knowledge.co.uk. Again, that's beyond-knowledge.co.uk. So, Marcus, if you will, tell us a little bit about what you're going to be talking about, an overview of your subject at the conference.
Right, indeed. The subject I'll be talking about at the Beyond Knowledge conference is the alleged Apollo moon landings. What do you mean alleged, I hear you say? They landed, didn't they? Well, that's what we've been told. I shall be looking at the evidence for the landings, and the evidence is mainly in the photographs and the films and the rocks and the books and the magazines and the fact that everybody knows that we landed on the moon. No. The evidence for the moon landings is extremely suspect. But I hear you say there are photographs of man on the moon. Yes, there are photographs that we were told by NASA showed men on the moon. Now, NASA, as we all know, stands for National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and it is the civilian face of the American space program. What not everybody knows is that NASA was created in 1958 as a department of the Department of Defense.
Right.
It was the civilian face of the Department of Defense, which meant that if America, and don't forget this is 1958, before any American had been in space, but it was just around the time following Sputnik's launch in 1957, where America suddenly woke up to the fact that the Russians were so considerably more advanced than they were in space exploration. Russia launched Sputnik, and the implication being that if they could launch a small little beeping ball of metal up into the 200 miles up, they could launch a nuclear bomb. Because that was the theory. And so America took fright, developed NASA, and said, we're going to land a man on the moon. Now, that was President Kennedy's famous statement in 1961. At that point, no American had been into space. They didn't know they could do it. But they thought, well, we have to say something to get the initiative back from the Russians. Because as we all know, America does not have the option of coming second to anybody.
Right.
So they decided to land a man on the moon. And they were going to do it live on television. Big mistake, doing it live on television. Supposing it all went wrong. Supposing you have an astronaut die in space, live on television. This would not be acceptable. So, and this is my contention, that in order to achieve their by now dead president's challenge of landing a man on the moon, it was necessary to ensure that what America and the world saw was a man landing on the moon. The pictures, the photographs, the films that we were all shown were all produced by NASA, which, as we all know, stands for Never a Straight Answer.
There we go.
Which is what you get if you ask them questions they don't want to answer, such as details about the photographs. Why are these photographs so good? When the astronauts were in an environment they'd never been to before, they were under threat of imminent death from radiation, from heat exhaustion. Because don't forget, the moon is very hot when you're in the sun.
Right.
And very cold when you're not. In fact, it's colder than anywhere on Earth when you're in the shadow. There's no atmosphere. That's why you have to have a spacesuit. And you're carrying a camera to take these photographs. It's a Hasselblad camera, the best camera you could buy then and the best camera you can buy today.
Right.
Made in Sweden.
Of course, yeah.
A very, very good camera. I've used them. I've also seen a replica of the camera that Hasselblad developed on NASA's instructions for use by the astronauts on the moon. And they all had one. The point about the camera is it had no viewfinder. It had no exposure meter. The shutter button was not visible from inside the helmet, which is why you couldn't have a viewfinder, because you couldn't use it. You had no means of knowing if you'd taken a photograph, because in space there is no sound.
Right.
The film counter was not visible from inside a spacesuit, and the batteries that advanced the film would have frozen solid within 5 seconds of being in minus 200 degrees Fahrenheit. But yet, we're told these photographs taken on the moon are some of the best photographs, the most iconic photographs of the 20th century. And if you look on the NASA website, you can see every single photograph taken on the Apollo 11 mission. 121 of them were mm-hmm. taken during the astronauts' time on the lunar surface.
Right.
Not one is out of focus, not one is overexposed, and nobody gets their head cut off. This all taken with a camera that has no viewfinder.
Right, right.
No exposure meter, shutter button not visible from inside the helmet, and manual operation of the focus, aperture, and shutter rings. As you know, Hasselblad uses Zeiss lenses, and they have individual settings for the shutter, the aperture, and the focus,
mm-hmm.
which are manually operated.
Right.
If you're manually operating the focus ring, how do you know you've got it in focus? Unless
you've
got a viewfinder, you haven't. But none of them are out of focus. It's magic. No, I contend these photographs were all taken under controlled studio conditions on Earth during the training and simulation exercises that were known to have been conducted. There's nothing secret about them. And there is no secret studio on Area 51 either. We didn't need it. All the photographs were taken by professional photographers under controlled lighting. And I will show in my presentation at the Beyond Knowledge conference how that actually can be shown to have occurred.
Mm.
There are additional light sources used when none were carried on to the moon, we're told. You will see detail in shadow areas where there should be no shadow, where there should be no detail. Because on the moon, the only light source is the sun. And what we're seeing is considerable fill-in with a light source which wasn't carried to the moon, with a reflector or with a flash gun.
Hmm.
Several of the photographs on Apollo 11 show evidence of a flash gun being used. It wasn't carried to the moon. There are many other points about this. I go into considerable detail, looking specifically at NASA photographs presented to the public as evidence for the moon landings.
Hmm. Fascinating.
One of the showstopper of space is radiation. We all know there's radiation in space. Space is a very dangerous environment for humans. We're not designed to go into space. And we will never go to Mars, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be dead before we get there. Anybody who tries it will be dead.
Hmm.
Now, the one thing that photographic film is very sensitive to is radiation, because, as we all know, photographic film records visible light,
right,
which is part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's the only bit we can see, but there's plenty more of it which we can't see, specifically the radiation, the gamma radiation, X-rays, and that's why all photographic film, and I'm not talking digital, they hadn't invented digital by the time of the Apollo landings.
Right.
This is ordinary Kodak film. That's why it all has an expiry date on it. Because if photographic film is left lying around for too long, it will gradually absorb radiation, or radiation will affect the emulsion, which will in turn become...
It will ruin the film.
Well, it'll gradually get ruined. The actual expression is fogging. Because that's what it will look like. It'll look like you took the picture through a fog.
Mm.
Now, you may recall many years ago when we went through airport security, if you were carrying film cameras, you always advised not to put the film through the X-ray machine.
Mm. Yeah.
Or it would damage it.
Sure.
Well, airport security is now a little bit more sophisticated, and it's not necessary, and it doesn't affect digital in the same way. But it did affect photographic film.
Hmm.
Now, why haven't we heard all this, you might say? And anyway, why didn't the Russians blow the whistle if they were so clever? Because they would have wanted to upset the Americans if they could. And anyway, I hear you say, what about the moon rocks?
Yeah.
And surely they must have landed on the moon because they put reflectors there, which people now fire lasers at and measure how far the moon is away.
Right.
All these questions will be answered at the Beyond Knowledge conference.
Mm.
I know why the Russians didn't blow the whistle. I know what the rocks are all about. I know about the lasers being fired at the moon. And it's all complete rubbish.
Well, that
nobody
sounds...
has landed on the moon. Because if it was so easy to get there, with the technology... 1960s, why is it going to take twice as long to get back with the technology of the 21st century?
Indeed.
Nobody's been back, and nobody's shown any evidence that man has ever landed on the moon, other than that produced by NASA. And do you trust NASA? Do you trust any government come to that?
No.
Rest my case.
No, it's going to be fascinating hearing your talk there, Marcus. Looking forward to it. As you might know, myself and Fredrik is going to be there, not doing any talk or something like that, but we'll definitely looking forward to meet up with some of you guys, researchers, and listening to your very interesting talks over there. So if you who are listening are interested in coming there to Liverpool, England, on the 3rd and 4th of May, head on over to their website there and check it out. It's beyond-knowledge.co.uk. What we are going to do right now is to take a short little break, and then Marcus and I are going to continue talking in our members section. And I definitely want to ask Marcus a little bit about the Crystal Skulls. There is an Indiana Jones film about this subject coming up, and this is one of the topics that I do want to talk more about. Also, maybe perhaps we could talk a little bit more about some of the Egyptology, possibly also go into a little bit of crop circles. Marcus has many, many interesting subjects that we do, definitely do want to continue cover here. So if you will, stay with us, Marcus, and we'll be right back after this break. The website is Red Ice Creations, R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. Click on subscribe and tune in to our continuation with Marcus Allen. Red Ice Creations members also have access to our radio archive going back to almost 2 years, back to 2006. Live programs, archived video of our live programs, short films, and much more. Thank you very much for tuning in, and thanks to Fredrik out in the control room. This is Henrik Palmgren. We'll talk more with Marcus Allen after this break.
Splendor, don't take offense at my innuendo.